Thank you, Jim. And our next order of business is to convene the executive. This is everybody, isn't it? It's the trainee. The trainee. Okay, so good morning, the executive committee. Our first order of business is to approve the agenda. So I'd like to move the agenda at this time. Is there a second? Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed, the agenda is approved. I guess that's what that is, right? Okay, next order is to approve the minutes. Where are the minutes? Okay, approve the minutes for September 13th, 2018 and September 13th, 2018 executive session. I'd like to move approval of the minutes. Is there a second? Discussion? Seeing none, all in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, the ayes have it. Okay. Okay, so I'd like to go over here the two items on today's agenda. The first is to approve a report from the Inspector General for posting. The second item on the agenda is the board's annual ethics training. Philip Staub, the board's ethics officer, will cover board members' responsibilities under the code, including use of official position, fiduciary duties, conflicts of interest, and disclosure. So we'll begin with the acceptance of the IG's report. So the executive committee has the responsibility of reviewing and accepting the audit and other reports by the Inspector General. The committee has reviewed the following report: audit of WMATA's blanket purchase agreements. Before we take a vote, Mr. Charrington would provide the committee with a brief overview of these reports.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. WMATA's blanket purchase agreements audit. WMATA risks overspending for repetitive supplies and services because administration of the BPA program needs improvement, missing and incomplete BPA documentation, and lack of BPA planning, monitoring, and closeout. As a result, $1.8 million of $1.9 million in our audit sample contain internal control issues. 31 of 45 purchase orders in our sample were older than 1 year or not closed out, which means $730,000 in funds in our sample could have been used for other WMATA needs. If projected to all BPA, $3.7 million in funds could be put to better use. Management agreed with our findings and has initiated actions to correct the noted deficiencies. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Charrington. Okay. I move that the Executive Committee accept this report and authorize the Inspector General's office to post them to the WMATA website. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, the ayes have it. Okay. Done. All right. Our next item is the board members' ethics training. So I'll turn this over to Mr. Staub. Staub. Mr. Staub, that's you, huh?
That's me.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to board members for giving me this opportunity to conduct your annual ethics training. Since all of you have had this training in the past, I've decided to use some real-life examples to make this perhaps a little more practical. The first of those examples is a report from July about a Marine general who used his aide-de-camp to conduct personal tasks such as picking up his laundry. That fits well into the rules that this board has for use of official position. I think you're familiar with these rules that are in both the WMATA compact and in the code of ethics itself. Since you're familiar with the specifics, I'll just say that the general concept, both in the news about the Marine General and for the Board Code of Ethics and Compact, is that board members should not use nor give the appearance they are using their official position with WMATA and inconsistent with their responsibilities to WMATA or to their respective jurisdiction. So with that, I'd like to move on to fiduciary duties and our next real-life news. Fiduciary duties appear in many contexts. Perhaps you've noted that there are increasing news about and lawsuits against retirement plan leaders and scrutiny for the investment decisions that they make. And this is one of those cases. NYU, I think, is dealing with about 16 separate suits regarding its retirement committee. The first decision came out fairly recently from the U.S. District Court in New York, siding in favor of NYU. But it's a worthwhile decision because it reviews the sort of due diligence and taking the role seriously that a court is going to look at when addressing a question of fiduciary duty, specifically the retirement committee members. Clearly had reviewed the documents before meetings. They asked questions. They did not take what a consultant reported always at face value. They disagreed, challenged the consultant, and the court found that that demonstrated their fiduciary duties. Absolutely, anytime. The duty already existed. They were fiduciaries to the plan, and that they, taking those actions, demonstrated that they were acting in accordance with those fiduciary duties. Okay. So at WMATA, the board members owe their fiduciary duties to two entities, Metro and their jurisdiction. Jurisdiction, I'll just note quickly, is a defined term in the code and includes more than just political jurisdictions like your appointing authority. The code also breaks down fiduciary duties into the four commonly recognized duties. And what I'm trying to represent in this chart here is that of those four duties, loyalty, confidentiality, and avoiding conflicts of interest are the same whether the board member is wearing the Metro hat, the jurisdiction hat, or both. And I'll just pause briefly on the conflict, avoiding conflict duty. That goes beyond what the code provides in terms of actual conflicts and apparent conflicts. It says whether or not it's specifically prohibited by the code, board members should avoid conflicts of interest. The other part that I'm trying to represent here is that the duty of care is, again, owed to both entities, but is a little bit different depending on which entity it's being exercised for. When it's being exercised for the jurisdiction, the duty of care is more about the responsibility to liaise regularly with jurisdictional representatives, to gather their views and be able to represent those at the board. Whereas the duty of care toward Metro is more about sort of leading us back to the NYU case, performing that due diligence, considering all views, and making reasoned decisions. And I should have mentioned at the start, yes, I'd take questions at any time. It actually does not need a law or the compact behind it. It's the nature of the board member's role to be a fiduciary, and the code just clarifies that. I'm sorry, when I speak of the code, I'm speaking of the code of ethics of the WMATA board. That is, the question was, do the duties flow to two entities or to one? And most commonly, the duties do flow to a single entity. That is typical of boards. In the board's code of ethics, it recognizes that board members are serving two entities and therefore have two sets of fiduciary duties.
Yeah, but from a legal point of view, which one trumps the other?
I think that would have to be situational. Again, the common body of law is that the if you're asking legally outside the metro context, the common body of law speaks to owing a fiduciary duty to the entity on which the member is serving. But the board code has set this up a little bit differently than that common law.
What about officers and directors' liability coverage?
Officers and directors' liability coverage as to whether they're exercising their fiduciary duties?
That's correct.
I would like to examine that before giving you an answer on that.
I think I know the answer, but you can examine it.
Okay. All right. Thank you. So I'd like to turn to conflicts of interest and another item from the news. And this one, perhaps the facts are a little complicated, but I'll explain why I like it. This is a news item from September where Merrill Lynch settled charges from SEC without admitting to those charges, that they failed to disclose conflicts of interest. What the SEC alleged was that when the Merrill Lynch Governance Committee recommended removing an investment advisor's products, what happened next was the investment advisor got wind of that, contacted Merrill, and offered other business opportunities, at which point Merrill tabled the idea of dropping those products and continued to recommend them to their clients. And the SEC said that that had to be disclosed to the clients before further recommending the products. The relationship with the investment advisor, the potential doing additional business with the investment advisor?
Not the initial decision,
that's right. So to me, this illustrates two things, that most often it's not having a conflict that causes a problem. It's a failure to address the conflict. And secondly, that matters of conflict of interest are always very fact-specific. Change one small issue here, a little bit of disclosure, a different advice from the guidance committee, and the conclusion would change completely. So this is something perhaps this graphic you've seen before. This is a way of presenting the defined conflicts of interest, or are called actual conflicts under the code. I don't want to lose sight, though, that the code also addresses apparent conflicts of interest, which are those that are other interests not defined in the code, of which the board member is aware, that it could reasonably appear to conflict with the fair and objective performance of their duties.
Excuse me, will you explain that for me, please?
Sure. I think I'll explain it through an example, because this again is another area where it's highly fact-specific. But we've had questions more under the employee code, which is roughly analogous, where a new employee comes in and has a relationship with a past employer, has had a past employer that now is seeking to do business with Metro. That doesn't present a conflict of interest so much a defined conflict of interest for WMATA. It may well present a conflict of interest if the employee has post-employment rules with its past employer. But the appearance of that, if they became involved in some matter where that business is seeking to do business with Metro, that it's our advice to them is always to disclose that and to at least consider recusing themselves or making clear to everybody involved their past relationship, so there's no question later that their actions may have been biased. Of course. I also want to touch briefly on household members. Under the code of ethics, among the interests that are defined are those imputed from household members. You may recall that we, in the last iteration of the code of ethics, add some clarity to the definition of household members, including dependent children. You sound like I light something on fire? Okay, good. Then beyond the issue of conflicts with household members, the code prohibits them being employed by Metro or being a party to a Metro contract during the board member's term of service. So I also like to reiterate the chart that I use on resolving conflicts, which points out that for those actual or defined conflicts under the code, there is one way of addressing that, and that's through recusal, in which case the board member does not participate, and not participating means not seeking to influence the matter in any way, whether at the board meeting or elsewhere. Now, on the other hand, with apparent conflicts of interest, board members have a choice. Recusal is an option, but with approval from the board chair, they can make a declaration, which basically says, I have this interest. I believe I can nonetheless participate fairly and in an unbiased way in this matter. And with that transparency out there, they can participate in the matter. So I'd like to move on to gifts. Are there no further questions about conflicts? I would expect that. Not at all.
Extending this session longer than he's also colleagues. The code of ethics. Who has standing to enforce it? Do the jurisdictions have standing under the code? Is this a legally actionable duty that you're describing, akin to the fiduciary duties of a corporate director under laws of the state of Delaware? Secondly, standing to enforce it in a court of law, etc.
Sure. Of course. What I would first say is that the Code of Ethics has its own enforcement mechanism. It first encourages members to work matters out with the ethics officer and with the ethics committee, which is the same as the executive committee. If that cannot be worked out to either the board members or the committee satisfaction, the matter then goes to a public session to be adjudicated. So I would anticipate that most issues would be handled along those terms. Whether some issues under the code of ethics could present legally actionable, I think some could. For example, we were just talking about conflicts of interest. That is part of the fiduciary duty, so that would be actionable under common law. But the main mechanism is within the Code of Ethics.
Right, and I'm not asking these questions to suggest that there's a basis for escaping liability, but rather to understand better the standing of the two parties to whom the directors owe the duties to enforce the duty against the representative of the board, academic in nature. But I want to ask these questions because your analogies to the corporate context, the fiduciaries, and board to
right. You make a very good point, that the analogy that I'm drawing, for instance, in the NYU case about retirement funds, the law there was ERISA. So there was a law in which to base an action. and this is not in the same nature of that. I mentioned that case more because it's a good discussion of how that retirement committee fulfilled their fiduciary duties, not so much to compare this board to that retirement committee and their duties under law.
I want to ask more questions.
Okay, sure.
Thank you all for
my question was answered.
Basically. Oh, excellent. Okay. So then I'd like to move on to gifts and another recent SEC settlement. Again, this is a settlement where United Technologies did not admit to the SEC findings, but the allegations were that United Technologies, in order to gain business opportunities primarily in Asia, did things that the SEC described as lavish gifts and travel. They made contributions toward events that didn't happen, which raised questions as to where that those monies went. And so gifts, proper gifts toward government officials are very much in the news. At WMATA, there is a general rule in our code against either soliciting or accepting gifts from prohibited sources. This also applies to household members. And while the code sets this out in some detail, including the exceptions that allow board members to accept gifts from prohibited sources in the appendix, I think it would be best to use a couple of scenarios to illustrate this. So the first scenario is about the U.S.-based Railcar Incorporated, who's seeking to build the 8000 series at Metro. These are all fictional. They're competing with some foreign companies. And they sponsor a dinner at the APTA conference called Buy American. So, again, just like questions of conflicts, gifts questions are highly fact-specific. But my recommendation is to approach them using these steps. First, ask, is the business a prohibited source? Then ask whether there's an exception. If there is an exception, next, always report the gift. The exception is not an exception from reporting. It's an exception that allows board members to accept the gift. There's always the requirement to report. And then to finally consider whether there's an apparent conflict as well. So to go back to the rail car example, pretty clearly here they are an interested party because they've sought business with Metro. Interested parties are prohibited sources, so that's the answer to the first question. Now, the wording here is they sponsor a dinner program at the APTA conference. That suggests that it's part of the regularly scheduled program at APTA. If that's the case, there is an exception that allows that, the widely attended gatherings, one element of which is part of the program. Then the board member would be permitted to use that exception and accept the gift and report that. Now, the issue of apparent conflict means later on if the board is dealing with a matter about rail car, the board member would either want to make a declaration or recuse themselves from that discussion having accepted this dinner from rail car. Now, change the facts slightly. Maybe they sponsor a dinner program. It's not actually at the conference. If you look at the fine print, it's actually at the same time as the conference is being held, but not officially part of the conference, which would place it outside of that exception and likely outside of any other exception. It would not be an acceptable gift. So the other scenario I wanted to talk about was...
So can I just ask you on that scenario?
Yes.
Because the scenario that you presented is happens very frequently
yes,
at these APTA conferences. So just to change the hypothetical a little bit, keep the first sentence, but the second sentence is They sponsor a reception at the Country Music Hall of Fame in Nashville, and they invite 1,000 of the 2,000 registered attendees to the conference.
Right. Well, the code, and that's an excellent question, because the code says you look for indicia of it being open to the public, being part of the regularly scheduled program, and the facts that you're adding place it outside of that, so the widely attended wouldn't work anymore. So you would look at other exceptions that probably, by the sounds of what you're talking about, wouldn't apply either, because, for instance, the $25 or under exception, it doesn't sound like what you're talking about is $25 or less. So
if it's cheap drinks.
Maybe. There's no entertainment in cheap drinks. Maybe that does get you within $25. But that's the sort of thing that generally board members would come to me about, and I would take a look at whether it would fit into any exception before providing the advice.
What's your umbrella advice here? Because, you know, you get a dozen of these things, and I don't go to any of them, but they seem fairly innocuous type events.
Well, certainly just a personal rule, if you had one, that you're not going to go to any of those, that would resolve a lot of questions. But if I had one piece of advice, it would be to, if you are considering going to these, to talk to your friendly neighborhood ethics officer.
Which is you.
That would be me. Yes. Sure. And that is something that I've guided members through before as well, how to pay a document paying for a matter and disclosing that. So the next example is, that let's just say an internet giant is looking for a new headquarters, and it decides wisely on the Metro Washington area, and even more wisely on a transit-friendly location. A developer, we're just going to call it developer, sees the opportunity in this and sends all local leaders, including Metro officials, a special edition of this internet giant's, we're just going to call them Nile, of their virtual assistant, a very popular device. It's a special edition, gold-plated, let's say, along with other promotional materials. So, again, let's take it question by question. Are they a prohibited source? Well, like I said before, interested parties are prohibited sources. Is it clear that Nile is an interested party? Are they seeking to do business with Metro? Do they have interests that would be affected by Metro? That might be a little vague here, but even if they are not an interested party under the code, the prohibited source also captures any entity giving a gift because of your position on the board. And that would fit here. They're sending it to local leaders. They are trying to gain favor with local leaders. You're receiving the gift because you are a local leader. So that would make Nile, in this instance, a prohibited source. So is there an exception? Well, this is a special edition virtual assistant. It's worth well over $25. I can't really think of another exception that would apply, so the outcome here would be to decline the gift. The issue is also that you already have received it. So in those situations, I again recommend contacting me, the ethics officer, and figuring out whether the item is going to be returned, whether it's going to be paid for and documented, whether it's going to be surrendered. I'm not quite sure what I would do with 8 virtual assistants, but I would figure out something. Let's just change the facts again very slightly. The Nile doesn't send you the developer doesn't send the virtual assistant. It sends, what do they call those things, the little dongles that go in your TV, the Fire Stick. Wait, that's Amazon. It's a matchstick or whatever it is. It's a casting device. It goes for about $15. Well, now that is acceptable because it does fall into an exception. You'd want to report that. Any questions about the gift scenarios? Okay, so one of our main points, actually there's one slide in between there, I think. Is it not there? Okay. So I was just going to emphasize disclosure with a bit with a headline that was in the New York Times on September 8th. It was about a top cancer researcher who is well renowned for his speeches, for his papers. He's an editor in chief of a prominent medical journal. He's been published in the New England Journal. He was a member of Sloan Kettering when it came out that he had not been disclosing that he had received millions of fees and had ownership interests in healthcare companies that were the subject of some of his studies and papers. That did result in him resigning from Sloan Kettering and other sort of negative attention. So that's an extreme example, but it does highlight the importance of disclosures. The board makes annual disclosures. The code calls for updates within 10 calendar days of when your situation changes on any of those matters covered in the disclosures. And, of course, as I mentioned, there are disclosures of gifts. So, finally, I want to wrap up with what the ethics officer does. This sort of sets it out. In short, I'm here to help. If there's anything else I can answer, I'm happy to. Thank you.
In accordance with the bylaws, I, Jack Evans, request that the Board of Directors convene an executive session to discuss the following matters pursuant to Article 2, Paragraph 9, Subsection A. Budgetary matters that may affect legal positions, WMATA contracts, or sensitive relationships with local jurisdictions or the federal government. And C, personnel or labor issues, including discussions of labor contracts and labor negotiations, consideration or interviews of candidates for employment, and the assignment, appointment, promotion, performance, demotion, or resignation of individuals. I'd like to move this at this time. Is there a second? Discussion? Seeing none, all in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? The ayes have it. So there's no further business to come before the committee. Meeting's adjourned. We'll see everybody upstairs.